Vancouver Island, a land full of rich, diverse cultures where you will find hippies and rednecks at the same local brew pub, blue-collar and white-collar camping side-by-side at the lakes, and old and young and everyone in between with one thing in common, we love our island. Welcome back to the Wild Islander Podcast, Season 2. Can't believe it's actually here, and so excited for all of the guests from Vancouver Island that you're going to get to meet over the coming weeks. This week, we have the privilege of having Derek Bird, the founding editor for Fly Fusion, a nationally recognized fly fishing magazine, and he's going to share his adventures across the province and especially here on Vancouver Island in the world of fly fishing. So in many of the different podcasts that I get to do, I usually have some sort of connection, obviously, with the person that I'm going to be interviewing.
Yeah.
And this week, it's a kind of a fun one because we've never actually met, but we've known, I think, who each other are at one level or another.
Yeah.
A lot of the same circles of people. Today we have with us Mr. Derek Bird. Welcome, Mr. Derek Bird.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah. Yeah.
Fellow islander.
Yeah. And it's true. I've heard so much about you from some of the students that I teach. Is, oh, you got to meet Benj. Benj is the best guy in the world. And, you know, Benj is, he does this and he does that. And you guys would love to, sit down and have a conversation. So it's funny that the very first conversation we're actually having is recorded. So.
I know, right? I know. It's for all those people that were like, well, they should be in the same room at some point in their existences. Well, there you go. We just went big.
That's right. Yeah. If you're going to do it, right? Why not record it for posterity's sake?
Totally. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. So you have the opportunity to work with a magazine, Fly Fusion magazine,
mm-hmm.
which is an absolutely fabulous, put together, beautiful, and incredibly informative magazine. How many years have you been a part of that?
Oh, man. Since its inception.
Sure.
Yeah. I want to say, it's funny. I should know the year. I think it was 2002, 2003 that we got it started. My brother called me one day and he said, there's no there's no super kind of credible fly fishing magazine in Canada. And I think that that's something that we could put together between you and I think that's something we could put together. And so he said, he's all, here's my vision for it. And then we kind of went back and forth a little bit on the vision. And I was a little bit wary about destination stuff. Right. Mm. Because I'm kind of a secret kind of outdoor guy.
Sure.
I'm a bit, not stealth is the wrong word, but I don't like to be noticed or seen out there.
You're a
classic, I don't know
BC
why.
Boy, man. Classic
I guess
BC
that's
boy.
It, right?
It's BC boy syndrome for sure.
When I'm out there, because every once in a while people will recognize me either from a TV show or from the magazine. And they're like, hey, are you, are you the Fly Fusion guy? And I kind of pull my hat down a little bit. Yeah, no, that's me. Right. So he called me one day and just said, yeah, I have this vision. What do you think? Mm. And I said, yeah, I said, except for the destination piece. I said, I don't want to cause kind of the herd mentality, right? Mm-hmm. I don't want to be we're all going to go here and then here's the next best place to fish. And, but I said, I'd be really into finding people that can teach people mm-hmm. how to become better at fly fishing.
Sure.
And he was like, yeah, no, that sounds good. And so then the next session was kind of a brainstorming session. Well, what are we going to call it? And so that was fun too. It took us about, I think it took us about 2 or 3 weeks to come up with a name for that. And we had, there was a couple other guys that were in on it at the time. They have a television show called Sport Fishing on the Fly.
Mm.
And they were in on it. And we threw around a whole bunch of names. And it was kind of getting to the point where, in the brainstorming session, after 2 or 3 weeks, where it became more of a slog rather than a kind of we're excited about this.
It.
Yeah, yeah. And one day I just put my head down on the pillow and I'm like, fly fusion, what? And so I started to think about that, and the more I said it, the more I'm like, oh man, it's like there's something explosive about it.
Totally.
Right? But
it sounds like a magazine.
It does, yeah. And the more that I said it, I kind of emailed my brother and said, here's one that came to mind, what do you think of this one? And he sent it off to the two other guys that were kind of helping us out with it.
Mm.
And it was crazy because sometimes I'd send over a name and they'd be like, it'd take a week or, at least a few days for them to get back. Yeah, no, I don't think so. That's not the one. This one, everybody's
saying no.
Yeah, it was within minutes of that one being sent out, everybody's like, that's it. That's the one.
Mm.
And so, yeah, so we went with it. And yeah, it's been really cool. Like there's been, you know, I teach high school full time. But I have taken a sabbatical from teaching and I've worked for the magazine full time as well. But all through, you know, whether I'm teaching or, you know, working for the magazine full time, I've always been writing for it. So there's not one issue where, you know, where I don't write for the magazine. So I have a column right up at the front of the magazine. It's called Streamlines. And yeah, I'm kind of I don't know. It's funny because the magazine was designed to kind of like be informative, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, cause really with fly fishing, it's, you know, you can kind of be at it for an entire lifetime and still not discover everything totally. That there is to know about it. Right. Like, it's just one of those
it's
kind of
so
like,
deep.
It's so, so deep. Diverse. Yeah, it really is. And so, so I don't know, it's kind of funny because I'm somebody that like, I love to do that. I love to like, you know, to study a lot about kind of the, you know, the entomology and the bugs and, you know, the dynamics of the cast and like all that thing where like all those types of things, where to go. And, but my writing, it doesn't reflect that. My writing is like, I'm kind of, I'm filled up. I'm inspired when I spend time by a river. Sometimes I'll go and spend time by a river and, you know, and maybe put the rod away even for a little bit and just sit there, just listen, right? And I'm sure anybody that spends time in the outdoors actually does that a little bit.
Absolutely. Where you're remiss not to, yeah. Right? You're missing out on an opportunity for
and
sure.
And so a lot of the writing that I do for the magazine, it has to do more with that. It's a little more philosophical. It's a little more kind of like, this fills me up. And I know that there's readers that it fills up too, right? And so I think that's kind of like, the connecting point. And then sometimes like, and I don't know if I'm like, I think that I used to be funny like when I was younger. I don't think that I am anymore.
Don't sell yourself short yet.
You know what? I said to somebody else the other day, I said, well, I guess it was either humor or hair, and I kept my hair. So although it's going gray, it's something that, you know, some of the articles that I write are kind of humorous. They're kind of tongue in cheek. And it's funny, those ones really connect a lot with people.
Sure.
Because people love to laugh, right?
And they're real.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
A lot of time that realism is the exact connection that you're hoping for, especially at the beginning of a magazine.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it draws you right in.
Yeah. One of the articles that I wrote tongue-in-cheek that I got some of the most mail from was actually about beards. It was kind of like a number of years ago when beards were kind of like, really kind of like when people were growing very full
beard.
Ones, the hipster beard. Yeah.
Fully did it. 2017. Check it out. It was amazing.
Oh yeah.
Full year. It was amazing.
So I was kind of against the hipster beard, but then who am I to say that? Cause I had a mullet in the 80s. So
we all had our time.
Right. Yeah. But anyways, that's like, I've written for the magazine the whole time. You know, kind of through the probably about 2015, 2016, I had some surgery one day and I was like, I had a week off of work and I was sitting back and I was watching the World Fishing Network. And I'd never really watched it before, even though I probably should have. I'd never really watched it before. And like after like an hour of watching it, I called my brother and I said, yeah, I know we're in the magazine space, but we need to get into the television space too, because everything that I see on the World Fishing Network is like, we can not only do that, we can do it well.
Totally.
Or we can do it better.
There's so many more opportunities, right?
Yeah. And he was like, that's a great idea. And my brother's the type of guy, when you mention an idea to him, it's like, if it's a good idea, he's kind of that person. He's a risk taker, right? Mm. And so
we all need those in our lives,
right? We do. Yeah. And so, yeah, within a month, he was like, Kate, you know, I found sponsorship, you know, we're going to be working with Patagonia and, you know, a few other companies and
just some small companies.
So, yeah. That's right. Yeah.
I found these small companies. Yeah. Online. I think they'll be okay.
and we're going to get out and film. And so that's what we did. And that kind of like, I love the writing part, but I think the filming part is like, that's, I don't know. That's pretty special. Like when you go out and go to these locations that, you know, a lot of people pay like, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars to get to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people kind of like, yeah, they open the door for you when you have, like, you know, cameras and, you know, you're part of a magazine. And it's just like that. Those are some of the best memories that I've had in the last, like, kind of 8 to 10 years, right? It's just going out and filming, and some of the people that I've filmed with have just been, you know, they're just ultra talented people. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So anyways, it's, yeah, there's lots of stories there too, but yeah. Talk about expensive equipment that they're using that, like, near water, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how they do it. I really don't. Like, the companies that were,
you know, freaking out with my phone, you know?
Right?
To be, like, quote, yeah, unquote, waterproof-ish.
Yeah.
Forget it. No, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And they're right there too. Like, a lot of the stuff that you've got for any of the videos you guys have done, like in the Rockies and stuff that I've seen.
Yeah.
They're right there on the water.
Oh man. You know, yeah.
With that stuff. And it's not necessarily like underwater gear. Like, I'm sure they have those underwater cameras there that they've got too, but I mean,
they do. Yeah. They're mainly filming with, like, with red cams, right? So these cameras that are worth kind of the price of a new vehicle is what they're filming with. And there's been, you know, there's been two different shoots that we've been on where they've gone under, or they've been immersed in some way.
Yeah, yeah. They're now on someone's mantelpiece.
Yeah, so exactly. Yeah, yeah. One of them was the result of a practical joke, which you know, a $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 dollar practical joke. That's kind of like
that's an expensive one. I mean, that's chump change.
That's a pricey one. Yeah, yeah. We were filming up in the Caribou region, and one of the jet boat drivers. We had two jet boats, and one of the jet boat drivers, he decided to play a practical joke on the boat that I was in, which had quite a cabin on it. But myself and the cameraman, we were kind of in the back part of the boat, which wasn't covered. Anyways, the other jet boat driver, he lifted up his jet engine a little bit and meant to spray the cabin, but he missed, and he hit myself and the cameraman who were standing in the back of the boat. The cameraman's got, you know, the red cam in his hand, and he just covered us in water, right?
Oh, no, there's
the camera and everything. And the cameraman kind of looked at the camera and went, yeah, that's it for filming today, you guys.
Yeah.
Right. Even though we have, you know, we have multiple cameras on set, it's kind of when one camera goes down, it's like,
let's reassess.
We're going to have to figure out what the rest of the day looks like. But yeah. Working with a magazine has been a pretty cool part of my life.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And I'm just very blessed to be somebody that has kind of got, yeah, I don't know. I got their foot in the door there, I guess. I don't know what you'd say, but yeah, it's, to be able to write about something that you love doing, to be able to go and film stuff that, you know, that you love doing.
And it's just something that begs to be written about. It really is because we were talking about our mutual friend Rick, who we've had on the show here before too. Like, it's such a romanticized sport, right? Like, there's films about it. There's just an elegance about it. And one of the articles that I remember that you wrote, I think it was in the June issue, I think last year, Faux Fame. And it was about, you know, everybody knowing this famous fly fisherman or something, right? That there's that connection.
Yeah.
But it's true. Like, when I read through the article, I was like, well, yeah, I remember those guys growing up, like watching them do this thing that was like otherworldly. Like, it just didn't match up with anything else that you did. You know, it wasn't like hunting. It wasn't like any other sport or anything. It was just elegant.
Yeah.
Inside of a world that you just didn't expect that, maybe.
Yeah. And I don't know it's funny because I don't know what it is about fly fishing, but it's like, but I think it's because it's a niche sport, right? Mm. Or it has been. I think it's really started to. And it's difficult. You know, I think that there's like, you know, there's a lot more people trying it or doing it. But there was a number of years where it seemed like kind of everybody who did it was either considered themselves famous, and I put, you know, I'm using air quotes right now. You can't see that, but I'm using air quotes right now. They either considered themselves famous or they had some type of a local fame, right? Mm-hmm. Because people, you know, when they hear that somebody fly fishes, they're like, I don't know what it is. There's kind of a magical aura about it.
Being able to interpret it.
Well, exactly. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so, I don't know. I don't know what it is. Anyways, that was a fascinating article to write. And I'm impressed right now that you read it.
I liked it.
Wow, Benj, you've done your homework. Nice job, man. Way to go. Yeah. Yeah. But it was a fun one to write just because I just took a number of different different incidents of kind of fame. And there are kind of a handful of people that are really like that are truly famous in the fly fishing industry. Mm-hmm. That you know, it's the result of kind of their fishing or their exposure. Sure. Why they're famous. Like there's famous people that fly fish. Mm-hmm. I think like Liam Neeson fly mm-hmm. fishes, Eric Clapton fly fishes.
Was it Viggo Mortensen one of those guys? Yeah,
he
did it
too. Apparently he fly fishes.
Yeah.
I think Emma Thompson. Is it Emma Thompson? Anyways, there's a bunch of different famous people that fly fish, but they're not famous because they fly fish. But there are people like, you know, there are social media influencers right now that, you know, I think people that have, I don't know what, say over 100, 110, 120,000 kind of followers, you know, through social media, I would consider them somewhat famous anyways.
Totally. Yeah.
And they've done that mm-hmm. through, you know, through fly fishing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. But anyways, this article about kind of the faux fishing, it was tongue in cheek. It was very much tongue in cheek because of like, I was just having fun with the concept of,
relatable though.
That everybody, everybody thinks they're, you know, everybody thinks that they're famous. And yeah, it was fun because on that one, there was, I fish one of the rivers around here, around Mid Island, quite a bit. And there was a guy that, there was a number of people that I'd run into during steelhead season, just walkers, right? Mm-hmm. They're out walking their dog or whatever. Mm-hmm. They'd say, oh, you know, what are you fishing for? I was steelhead. And they'd be, oh, you must know Bobby. We'll call him Bobby, right? Yeah. You must know Bobby. And, oh, no, I've never. Well, he steelhead fishes this river and he does really well. Oh, okay. You know, I hope you run into him one day. Yeah, that'd be great. I'd love to run. Anyways, this happened over and over and over again where I'd run into kind of dog walkers who would say, oh, you must know Bobby. Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, yeah, no, I haven't met Bobby before.
He sounds pretty cool though.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And he sounds like somebody that I could learn a lot from totally. Because like steelhead are really hard to catch, right? So anyways, it turned out in the end that that I was on this river one day and I was looking over a bank. I was looking down and I was actually like trying to see if I could see any steelhead. And I heard this voice behind me and I turned around and there was this guy standing there. And so he had a fly rod in his hand and we started talking. Mm. About 20 seconds into the conversation, he looked at me kind of oddly and he's like, have we met before? And I said, no, I don't think so. No. And he said, no, I've met you before. I know I've met you before. And then he rattled off kind of a few places at me and no, we haven't met. And then we carried on. And then he stopped again. He went, oh, you're the Fly Fusion guy. That's how I know you. and I said, I am. And he said, he kind of stuck out his hand. We, you know, we shook hands and he said, hi, I'm Bobby. And which I started laughing, right? Oh, totally. Because I'd probably heard more about him than he knew about me just from all the people that I'd met. So it was kind of cool to have that kind of come full circle. And
oh, totally.
Yeah. But anyways, yeah.
Love that.
That's yeah. Awesome. I'm still impressed, Benj. I'm still impressed that you read that article. I'm like, wow.
No, it was good. It was great.
Yeah.
So then kind of where I wanted to go from there is why fly fishing? Because obviously there was somebody, you know, or something in your life that kind of drew you to that. Like I kind of alluded to it. That's something I've dabbled at the very, very, you know, I've caught trout.
Yeah.
So I did something right. I have mastered that in, you know, 1 week in May on a particular lake, there is one fly that I know that works.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's my knowledge.
That's all you that's need my to knowledge. Know, yeah, right?
That 1 week is heaven
yeah, for me. That's right.
But obviously you've had people in your life and you've had mentors, you've had opportunity, whatever it is, that's inspired you to be where you are today, wanting to tell people about fly fishing, wanting to be an influencer in that community, whether by design or just by you being good at it. Yeah. So what kind of brought you there? What was kind of the inspiration for you? It's a big one. But.
Wow. Yeah. And what a great question. Really, really good question. I don't know. The why is something I've thought lots about. And then at times where I'm just like, you know, I don't know if I need to actually like overanalyze it. But if I follow kind of my path as far as like fly fishing and kind of what I've been able to do kind of with fly fishing. And when I follow my path, it just had everything to do with a little kid wanting to be like his dad. Sure. Like kind of, you know, end of story almost, right? Mm-hmm. Like when I think back on it, it was like, you know, my dad, and this gets me a little bit emotional, right? I don't know why, but it's like, there's something about kind of father, son, like bonding in nature that when I look back on it, I'm like, man, I was so blessed to have a dad that like, you know, towards the weekend, he would pull out the big topographical. Are you too young to know what a topographical map is?
No, for sure. I'm tracking with you.
Yeah. So he would pull out the big topographical maps and, you know, we just like he'd roll them out on the table and we'd, you know, I can remember as a little kid, just like he'd be like, oh, yeah, this is where we're going today, son. Like, yeah. Or this is where we're going to go tomorrow. And I can remember just being like so enamored with the topographical map, with the fact that I could see on the piece of paper where we were going to go.
Straight up treasure hunting, man.
That's exactly right? What it was. That's exactly what it was. And at first, he was a genius dad because he started us out spin casting. I think that it's kind of crazy for anybody to start their kids out fly fishing.
Oh, yeah. The entire time that I've ever done anything with my kids with fishing, I have not fished for quite a few years because I'm untangling.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
So I can't imagine trying to do it.
Kudos to anybody that that starts their kids out fly fishing. But I think if you start them out with a spin, you know, with a spinner or a bobber and a worm or whatever,
yeah,
like then all the power to you, right? Because your kids, the biggest thing for them, they don't care that, you know, that the rod costs whatever, however much money. They don't care kind of that you can present a fly an inch from the bank and make it look like something natural. They don't care. They just want to catch fish, yeah. Right? And that my dad, he must have recognized that because that's what, you know, he put a spin rod in our hands and away we'd go. And he gave us some space too out there, right? Which I think as a kid, you know, you want that.
Yeah.
I think you want a little bit of space. You want to know that you can do it by yourself, right? And so
a big independence teacher, because I remember that growing up with my dad too, like that was something like when I actually felt like I did it after watching,
right?
It's something that's very empowering. Yeah. It doesn't matter what age you're at.
Yeah.
It's something that like I did that thing, right? Yeah. And it's kind of that passing of the torch in a really neat way too.
Yeah. So he showed us how, and then after a while it was probably around 8 or 9 years old where I started to look at him and realize that he was doing it differently. And I wanted to do it like him. And because he had a fly rod and I wanted to learn how to do it like him. So he started to show me and he got me to a point where I could, you know, I could cast and I have an older brother and a younger brother. My older brother is 2 years older than me. And so he was probably 11 and this was back in the days of like free range parenting, right? Where you just kind of let your kids just kind of go out and
no one told me.
I'd wish that it had never ended, right? In the summers, my mom had just kind of like, there was this lake, it was probably about 5 kilometers from our house. And at 9 and 11, you know, we'd tie our fly rods onto our bikes and we'd ride to this lake like 5 kilometers from our house. And like, to me, that's unheard of nowadays. Totally. Right. But that's what my mom would let us do in the summers. And we'd just go there and we'd fish all day. I can't remember bringing water or sunscreen or anything. So, which that might prove to be really bad later on in life, but
so far I'm doing
okay. But yeah, no, we'd ride our bikes to the lake. We'd just fish there all day and we'd catch trout. It was a stock lake, right? And so we'd catch lots of trout and we'd just come back. And that was where I started to really learn how to fly fish. So yeah, I remember catching a kid in the back one time with a fly, and that was kind of a learning experience for me, kind of like how far he was standing behind me watching, because he had never seen anybody fly fish before. He was kind of a portly boy with no shirt on. And I, on the back cast, I pulled up and I thought I was kind of in a weed. And so I pulled harder and I heard this kid yell and my line behind me was taut and in this kid's back. So, but we managed to get the fly out. And then my dad, I can't remember if he had lent me his fly rod or if I just took it. I can't remember, but one of the two happened one day. And I remember catching it behind me on some weeds and I broke it. And that was big because he used to talk about that fly rod a lot because it was one of his friends that actually built that fly rod for him. And so I remember, and that was another thing. I remember having to like, the last thing I want to do is go home and tell my dad that I'd broken his fly rod, right?
Oh, totally.
But it was just another learning experience in life where you kind of had to man up, right? Yeah. Where you kind of like, you know, are you gonna hit this square on? Or, and so I did. I remember not wanting him to come home to it, so I remember calling him at work
and giving saying some warning, to him, you know, yeah, space is a good thing.
That's right. I called him at work, and he was so gracious about it. Mm. He just said, "Well, it's a fly rod, son. So
yeah,
so we'll be able to, you know, it's not good that it's broken, but we'll be able to we'll be able to get around that." So I think that he saw that fly fishing was something that was like so. It was so, you know, important to me, or it was something that I had just kind of fallen in love with, that he didn't want to, you know, maybe he didn't want to raise his voice about it, right? Maybe he saw something kind of more important there than a broken fly rod.
Sure.
Right? And so I think as dads, like now that we're dads, right?
Yeah.
I think you see those moments in life where you could really get upset.
Yeah.
But then taking a moment and kind of seeing the situation for what it is, and kind of like taking a breath and going, shoot, like I want my kid to have, you know, good memories about this. And yeah, this, you know, he can work it off, or he can, you know, figure something out about it to kind of like, you know, repay or whatever has to be. But yeah, anyway, so that's kind of my dad. He was my mentor.
That's
and
cool.
Then it kind of just went into, you know, it went into friends after that. It was like, you know, at 15, kind of before we get our driver's licenses, we were, you know, now we weren't just riding 5 kilometers to a lake. Now we were riding kind of 15 kilometers out to the closest river and
getting choosy.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where we were spending our days. And, you know, some of my best friends were guys that fly fished, and that's what we do. We just ride to the, you know, ride our bikes to the rivers. And I grew up in the Rockies, and we ride our bikes to the rivers and just fish all day. That's what we did in the summers, right?
Yeah.
And then life gets more complicated, right? Because then
you get
jobs and girlfriends and all that kind of stuff. But those are some really fond memories looking back. And so why do I fly fish? I don't really know, Benj. I think that fly fishing I don't know if anything chooses you, but I feel like I've never really not fly fished. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe it chose me. I don't know. My grandfather was a fly fisherman. When he died, he gave me it's a 1956. I think it's a 1956 Hardy knockabout split cane rod, and I still have that. Yeah, I inherited that from him. So I don't know. Maybe it's kind of in the blood too, right?
Sure.
I don't know. It's just
that generational thing, right?
Yeah.
That sometimes gets carried on past, and you don't necessarily have answers. You just know that it has value.
Yeah. No. Exactly.
Yeah. No. That's really really cool.
Yeah.
So was it just you and your brothers, or and that kind of the family, or did you do that with extended family? Was that like something past that, or was it mostly just kind of your community? Like,
yeah, no, it was mainly just myself, and it was like at first it was myself and my older brother, and a few of the friends that we had, or that we'd meet kind of at the lake or whatever, right?
Yeah.
At first it was that, and then my younger brother he got into it a little bit later. He didn't do it right away. And I can remember, it was a little bit later that he got into it, but I remember he was kind of, and I don't think he'd mind if I said this, you know, publicly, but he was kind of the black sheep of the family. Right. And,
I get angry emails.
Right.
Now.
Yeah, I know. Right. Just from one person.
Just from one person.
Yeah. He was kind of the black sheep of the family. And I remember at like, I think I was probably in my early 20s and naively thinking, you know, if I can just take him fly fishing, then that'll kind of help course correct him. Right. And I don't know if it did when I hoped it would, but I think maybe it did in the long run. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
Like,
yeah.
I think we, in our minds,
long-term
we're like,
investment.
Yeah. Yeah. In our minds, I think, you know, if we take somebody out, you know, and they're struggling in life or whatever, we take them out, you know, fly fishing, or take them out hiking, or, you know, hunting, or whatever it be, right?
Mm.
We're kind of like, oh, you know, they'll have that moment where they'll realize that, you know, that there's life kind of outside of civilization.
Yeah.
And there's a lot that goes on in the world that we have no control over.
Mm.
And there's something about that that's super humbling, right? Yeah. Like just immensely humbling, that kind of reminds us that, that we're part of something that's way bigger than ourselves, like way bigger than ourselves.
Absolutely.
And so, that was with my younger brother. I think eventually he came around, but I don't know if it had anything to do with that. I remember one time I was telling him, cause he had started smoking, and I remember telling him, Chris, you know, you're going to like, you know, all the, you know, all the hiking and stuff that we do, you're not going to like, you're going to have trouble doing that. Cause we used to do some high elevation stuff. Mm-hmm. Right. And I remember trying to prove that to him one day where I took him out. We were hiking this one peak. It was 10,000 feet. And I took him out there specifically because he had been smoking for a number of months. And I'm like, I just didn't want him to you know, not be able to, I wanted him to see how much his lung capacity had diminished. Right.
Good trial by fire. Where right? are you at in life
yeah, yeah.
so far?
Yeah. So I can remember taking him out on this hike and he, and we did it and he beat me to the top and he sat at the top and he lit up a cigarette and he sat there and smoked it as I'm like coming over the crest of the peak. Right. He's just sitting there smoking and I'm just like, oh man. But yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of naivety in our youth, but I think that that's so good. Like, I think that kind of that's how worlds change, right?
Yeah.
Is because people are naive and don't realize how difficult something is or how, you know, how much work it'll take or whatever. And so they do it and, you know, and they start to navigate through it. And yeah, anyways, I kind of got off on a bit of a tangent.
No, I love it. Yeah. I love it. And I think that's kind of the neat part about your story is not just the fly fishing side of it, not just the technical part, not just, you know, all of those things that are really fabulous and can be witnessed, sure, by what you do, but it's the storytelling. Mm. It's the reason why it matters and how you weave that into mm-hmm. the story. I mean, that's the outdoors in a nutshell for anybody who actually has any type of passion for it in whatever field that they're in, right? Is that a lot of the time you see them turn into storytellers. I mean, that's why I do this podcast, because you want to hear people's stories of what inspired them. Why did they decide to become good at it? And is it something maybe that is accessible, you know, for them?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it's, there's something about, even with the, sorry, just my mind is going now about the risk reward thing. And even, even kind of like, even, you know, as you're growing up too, right? Mm. The risk reward and the naivety that goes along with kind of like the risk reward at that age, or kind of thinking you're invincible.
Oh,
there's
100%.
You know, in fly fishing too, actually anything probably outdoors, you start to, and you do it, I think, mostly in a healthy way, like, you know, as you're growing up. Mm-hmm. I think you begin to realize how far you can push limits and how far you can't, mm-hmm. right? Now that's a general statement. I realize that some people push them too far and, you know, don't get to tell the story about it. But
the difference is that you know that it's there.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But generally speaking, you know, there is, you know, look, and again, kind of, you know, in the era of kind of the free range parenting and my mom and my dad just, go ahead, go fishing, mm-hmm. right? Like, just go out there. There was like, you know, there was stuff that, you know, that we'd do where you'd learn that, you know, you learn boundaries pretty quickly, right? Mm-hmm. And at 15, I remember almost drowning because I tried to cross a river and I was probably about 90 pounds wet at 15. And, you know, I had a buddy.
Buoyancy was at an all-time low.
Exactly. Yeah. I had a buddy that I was fishing with. His name was Bryce. And Bryce was, he was a solid kid. He was probably, you know, he was probably about 200 pounds, 210 pounds. And we tried to cross the river in the same spot. And I got about halfway across the river. And I remember because at that age, of course, everything's better on the other side, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And so you have to get there, right?
That's what it's there for. The other side exists for that reason.
Well, exactly. And I remember kind of getting to a point where I felt I could feel fear, right? Mm-hmm. I could like feel like this really healthy fear, like this isn't going to go well if I keep going. But then I turned around and I realized that going back was going to be probably just as impossible.
Yeah.
And so I took another few steps and that was it. I was just swept away and I hit a rock and I remember going under. I remember losing equipment. Like I lost my fly rod and, you know, I lost my fly box that because I held onto my fly rod. But the funny thing was, like after I came back up, right? And the funny thing was, and looking back is after I came back up, I got pushed to an area that was quite calm and I stood up and I remember being like, I remember thinking, wow, like that was scary. Like that was like legitimately fearful.
Yeah.
And I looked across the river and my buddy had made it across all the way across and he was standing there in his underwear. He had taken all of his clothes off. And so I yelled over at him. I said, why? Like, why are you standing there in your underwear? And he said, I was going to jump in and save you. But what strikes me as funny looking back on that is he must have not been thinking clearly because he was already wet because he had just crossed the river. So why was he taking
this
his
clothes
off?
This is what they do in the movie. Right? I know this is the part I'm supposed to do.
Yeah. But anyways, there was, there's lots of those incidents. I remember one day in spring, it was a pond and my brothers and I, we had a hatchet and and I think that there's more kids that do this than not, like outdoor kids.
Oh yeah, I'm
Cause,
sure.
Because we chopped off some ice that was around the side and we wondered if we could use it as a raft and we could.
Oh yeah.
And
that's
so.
Fully logical.
Right?
Yeah, completely.
And so we.
I'm not saying I haven't done it myself.
Right. So we grabbed a pole and there we went. There we went. You know, we were out on this little raft ice adventure and it was great. You know, until mom showed up because she was there to pick up our younger brother and he was out there and she wasn't happy about that.
That's
I remember.
About the age you stopped telling mom stories.
Right.
You
yeah.
know,
yeah.
At that point, you're like, we were having a great time.
Yeah.
But it is true. Like, it kind of dislodges some memories for myself. You don't hear any talk about that too. Like, as you grow older, and those different milestones that happen, mm-hmm. how many times you start to assess, you know, the risk, mm-hmm. and you look at things. So, like when we would do climbing and stuff, and I remember doing Victoria Peak with a couple of my buddies.
Oh, you've done Victoria Peak.
Oh, it's spectacularly beautiful. It's a beautiful day, and going up and doing this. I just had our first son, and I think it was my first climb as a dad. Everything had changed. Mm. So all the ones that I'd done before, no problem. Lots of fun, you know, really great. Put me on the edge, doesn't really matter.
Right.
But that responsibility factor and how that all of a sudden refocused absolutely everything.
Yeah.
You know, it changes your whole worldview. And it's really,
really
quite fascinating. And but it's what's really neat is hearing again the pieces of what your dad did and inspiring you for, you know, the different things that he did and being able to pass that on and then you passing that on and I love that cycle. I mean, that's what the outdoors should be all about, whatever the venue is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm jealous that you've done Victoria Peak. I have to say
it's pretty spectacular.
I can say with near certainty that I'll never do it. But it's one of those ones I can see it out my classroom window.
Oh, totally.
And I often look at it and cause I can see kind of all, you know, I can see, Mount Beadnall and Alexandria Peak and Mount Adrian and Albert Edward. Like I can see all those out my window and then off in the distance up towards Sayward, I can see Victoria Peak as well. It's Victoria and the Warden, right?
Yeah.
Is that,
Warden's the shorter one.
That's
like
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can see those out my window. And I've said, ever since I was a young teacher, I've said, oh, one day I'm going to climb that. And now I'm looking back and going, one day has passed for me. Yeah. I don't think I'll ever make it to the top.
I'm really happy I did it when I did it because I don't know that I'm going to go back.
Right?
Yeah. It's just one of those things that you're like, you know, that when you're in the hiking world and you're doing that nice trail that goes somewhere that's really quite fun, but when you've got exposure, whole different ballgame.
Yeah, because there's places in there that, do you have to clip in or is there?
Yeah, there is. Yeah. I mean, somebody listening to this would be like, why would you ever clip in? It's like, well, a lot of other people do. Like, it's recommended for sure. Like, it depends on your comfort level. But as far as a couple of the moves, there is like one or two that you need to do.
Yeah.
But still, unbelievable. Like, a lot of mountains that I've been on top of, like, they're really super solid. Mm-hmm. That one just feels like a big pile of rocks.
Mm.
Does not feel very solid at all.
Wow.
But it is pretty neat.
Yeah.
If anything looks volcanic, it's that thing. It's pretty neat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I definitely look up at it for sure. Yeah.
So switching gears just a little bit, I wanted to kind of look into a little bit of the technical side because there is that mystique and I'm not asking for all your secrets. I'm not asking for any of that. I'm not going to say it right, but your editorial write-up for your biography is one of the most genius things that I think I've ever seen. Where you basically give no information but totally make fun of the entire thing. Where you love the you know it best. You got to say.
Oh yeah, I can't even remember what I said, but it is that exactly. It's like I wish I had it here so I could read it.
I'm gonna see. It's like I love the river where the trout are.
Yeah,
I love the fly that the fish are catching.
That's right. Yeah.
There's something along
again,
that line, right?
So, again, I'm impressed, Benj, that like you almost know more about my article than I do. I wrote that one. We changed the format in the magazine.
Okay.
Just, I think it was two years ago now. And and when we changed the format in the magazine, that's when I wrote that little intro. That little intro in that. And that's all just tongue in cheek, right? Because it's like, that's exactly what it is. It's like, I'm here's the fly, but I'm not going to tell you what it is. But here's where they're biting, and I'm not going to tell you where they're biting.
Exactly,
right?
and trying to get any information out of anyone who fly fishes, unless they're like a close confidant,
right? Yeah,
is really quite difficult. So I'm not mining for details, but for those that maybe have no real reference on the process,
right?
So a little bit about how it works, in like layman's terms, if you will, for the regular folk like myself. Who really don't know the difference between a nymph and anything else. You know, we know that it's a technical term for some sort of bug, maybe.
Right, yeah.
But if it was in Trivia Pursuit or something, I'd probably say it was from some sort of mythical creature. But yeah, like a little bit about that.
Sure, about technical stuff, and where to start. I just want to tell you one thing to go along with that little write-up, the information that basically tells you nothing, right?
Yep.
Like there's this one fly that I use. Because I do have a few spots like on Vancouver Island that.
Well, I'm gonna be that guy, and I'm not trying to be cruel or anything like that, but we're gonna carry on the rest of the story of Derek Bird and what he's doing up for Vancouver Island specifics, and also for what he's gonna talk about for different tricks and tips and stuff for the fly fishing world next week on the Wild Islander. So you're gonna have to stay tuned for part two of Flies and Fish and hear all about his experiences and some hopefully some information that's helpful if you're looking at getting into fly fishing. Thanks so much for joining us on the Wild Island this week, and a special thanks to Derek Bird for being a part of this project. And I ask just anybody who's been listening, make sure to subscribe on whatever podcast platform that you are currently using, whether it's Spotify, Apple, Google, whatever. Please leave what you think about the show as we go along. We really want to hear back from you. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook as we continue the campaign for season two, which is going to carry on right to the beginning of summer. Thanks so much for joining us, everybody. Hope you have a wonderful week, and we'll see you soon. This episode is brought to you by Imagine Camping. Imagine Camping has been on Vancouver Island since 2013, making the Fireside Fork. The Fireside Fork is the handiest, dandiest tool that you could hope for outside cooking anywhere just about on Vancouver Island. Whether you're on a campfire or a barbecue, it is an incredible tool to have with you. It's rapid cooling, it's got a nice portable carry case that you can have come with it, and it all collapses right down and makes it extremely accessible for all your outdoor adventures. We really love it with our kids because it's really rapid cooling. It cools down really fast after it's been used, and so we're not dealing with burned hands and all of those crazy mishaps that could be happening at a normal campfire. Go check out the Fireside Fork at imaginecamping.com, where right now they are having a sale for, you can get a two-pack with a carry case for $25. Check it out, imaginecamping.com.